Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Pearlman. My guest is poet and educator Edward Dougherty. Dougherty received his MFA in creative writing from Bowling Green State University. He is currently a professor in the communications department at Corning Community College, where he teaches creative writing. He is the author of many chapbooks and poetry collections, including Part Darkness, Part Breath, Pilgrimage to a Ginkgo Tree, and Everyday Objects. His most recent is a truly beautiful collection of spiritual and meditative poems entitled Grace Street. It was published in March of this year by Cuga Lake Books. And welcome to the show.
Hi, Tish.
So nice to see you again.
It's great to be back.
Now, a lot of your poetry has focused on spiritual and philosophical concerns, but Grace Street feels like it goes a little deeper. Was that where you were heading with this?
Well, the book, again, took a long time to write, so I guess it's one of the major concerns of my life. I continue returning to it. I was raised in a very devout Catholic home, and that spirituality really gave me a great foundation for perceiving the world and the relationships, personal and in the natural world. So I think it's just part of who I am.
Yeah, but it feels like you're sharing more now. It's like you're letting us in on some almost private, worlds.
This book, I describe it as angel wrestling. Some of the faith questions, both of orthodoxy, but also how do you live that out? It's one thing to say you believe something, but how does it manifest in your daily life?
Yeah.
So that makes sense to me that it would feel more personal and more disclosing.
Now, do you think this is just the process of Edward Dougherty's life, or as so many people tell me, when they get older, they get a little bit more spiritual sometimes?
Well, I was a weirdly spiritual kid. I remember, I don't know, I had to be like third or fourth grade, and where I went to school, altar boys had to be in, I think, the fourth grade. And so my third grade summer, I went every day to Mass so that I could be the altar boy. It was a big deal for me. And my whole family, we were very tied to the parish church and the school. So it may be a deepening, a ripening for me, but I don't know that it's a new expression.
Yeah. But it's a beautiful book, Edward, really.
I'm
really impressed. Now, let's have you read an excerpt from one. These are long poems in different sections. So this one's called The Pencil.
Yeah.
And this is actually one of my favorites. You want to tell us a little about it, since you're not going to read the whole
thing?
Sure.
You had mentioned the book Everyday Objects, and at the time that I was writing those poems, I was also reading the book that I quote a line from, called The Secret Life of Everyday Products, about the pencil. And it evolved into more of a meditation on writing and the sense that writing with a pencil is pretty impermanent. So that was a great way into mortality and the preciousness of human birth.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's listen to this.
Okay. This is the section next to the last. In the oldest poem, Enhedwana's yearning in this house of enormous size. It was pressed into clay 4,300 years ago. A moon priestess, her longing molded words into prayers, entreating the goddess of love. Woman, princess, poet of sacred affection, was heartache, that soul sorrow we put into a pump of an organ, the same to you? What lasts in this realm of feeling, passing like a gnat cloud on a summer afternoon? Can we make ourselves soft enough to receive the angled shapes wedging into the surface?
Oh, that's beautiful.
Thanks.
It's really beautiful. Thanks. Now, since Grace Street, like I said, is longer poems in different sections, did you write each poem at the same time, or did you write a section and leave it? And then, how did you do that?
It was, maybe this is one of the reasons why it took so long. Some of it is, I call it recycled, poems that I felt like were finished but weren't very good on their own.
Uh-huh.
So I started gathering them up either thematically or just seasonally and listened for the way they juxtaposed, whether they evoke something new in the putting together. And then I like the, I don't know if this is really true for a reader's experience, but I was composing musically, listening for harmonies and correspondences in tone and feeling rather than in narrative, what it was saying.
Mm.
So there were a couple of poems in the book that really are assembled. Then I had to really polish the pieces so that it felt like, even though they were separate sections, it felt like one whole thing.
Wow. Oh, God, that must have been a real challenge.
Yeah, I was really out of my depth.
But it worked.
I showed it to a friend of mine along the way, and I said, I don't even know what I'm doing, let alone whether what I'm doing is resulting in anything good. And he was really encouraging. He said, I think this is the best stuff I've seen you write.
Oh, me too. And I have been a follower of your work, and this is the third time you've been on my show, so
thanks,
I know your
thanks.
Work very well. This is beautiful stuff. So maybe these fragments were meant to be a whole. You know, they were waiting.
They do feel that way. Now that I see them all together, there's a, not inevitability, but now that I've forgotten what's left out, they do feel whole to me.
Yeah, well, they read that way, too.
Good.
Let's go back to, you said you were brought up a Catholic.
Mm-hmm.
Now, these poems aren't religious, you know, obviously, but they are spiritual.
Yeah.
Is this you just taking from the Catholicism into a spiritual form, or have you left some of the Catholicism behind and tried a different quest for your beliefs?
For my beliefs, yes. I applied for membership to our Quaker community in Elmira. And I think of the silent worship, Quaker worship, as that moment in the Catholic Mass after you've received communion. So there's this quiet reflection. And usually when I go to Mass now, that period feels too short.
Mm.
But it's that sense that now we have received communion, we have received God, and we must now find a way to embody that in our lives. So Quakerism, for me, feels like the distillment of the Catholic spirituality or Christian spirituality more generally.
Yeah.
But I've also had a really long-standing sense for Buddhism as well.
Yeah, I remember that.
The Zen tradition really speaks to me, particularly in its use of language, its paradox, trying to get at what is ineffable. You can't really put your words around it, and yet it's so meaningful and it's so important that we have to try.
Yeah.
So that tradition in Zen is pretty important to me, and we sit in a meditation group every Wednesday in Elmira. So it's still a convergence, but it wouldn't be Catholic for me.
Yeah, yeah. It feels to me that you're carrying communion to your poetry.
Oh, that's great.
Which, you know, because I was brought up as a Catholic as well.
Oh, really?
So, and I left the church many, many, many years ago. But I can feel, you know, almost like the leap.
Yeah, there's a tradition, Matthew Fox, who's, I think, a Dominican, has a book called Original Blessing, and the idea that the God's work of blessing precedes and supersedes the fall and the sense of sin, that spirituality really speaks to me, that creation is good.
Mm-hmm. Let's have you read another excerpt from Gray Street. This poem is called Chicory Flower Song. Tell us a little bit about it. This feels like a real meditation.
Yeah. We used to live in Elmira, and our backyard faced what's now 86. It was 17 at the time, so it was big highway, but if I looked across our yard, across the highway, there was an old quarry, a hillside on the other side. So that's the kind of the frame of the poem, is that I'm standing on the edge of our rented lot looking across the road. But that sense of being rooted in a place, being a householder amid and beside all the travel, and finding that sense of place is really important to me, and it became a central idea in the book.
Mm-hmm.
So this section is that rootedness in a place. It's also the second to the last part. I lay my body down in a bed of cricket song and rise again to mist in the crow trees. The spirit's a vessel where light never bottoms, where we pour in the glass beads of our daily dreams, our countless endeavors, each smaller than the last, until talc-fine sand fills in, though openings yet exist where the undiscovered moves. What I know slips a gap-tooth gear. What I know of God couldn't illuminate a cicada's wing. Still, I write these notes to leave in the rain. I've been loved, often extravagantly, and the wire of it hums all the answers I seek. From the pulpit, with ohm carved into its fragrant wood, love's the only gospel proclaimed. Concelebratory vibrations of being fuse body and spirit, voice and will, past and future, word and silence, and now this reading, our vast text.
These poems are really very beautiful. Were you really laying in nature? I mean, how much is nature really part of your life? Every writer I've talked to has told me, for the most part, that it's huge in their lives. You seem to have taken a microscope to it, though. You know what I mean?
I enjoy it.
It's intimate and it's up close.
I'm glad it feels that way. I know my spouse is a big gardener, and she's far more intimately involved with nature, participating in it. I'm more of a sit in the Adirondack chair and observe it, kind of. But whenever we're out walking and I'm able to allow the inner chatter to die down, there is a broadening of myself. I feel more connected to everything. And when that happens, I know that this is my true home.
Yeah. And can you feel poems bubbling up when you're feeling that way? Or is it mainly that, you know, that blankness of being that's what we're all trying to strive for?
Yeah, I hear the distinction you're making. The poems, for me, can be two things. First, I have a longstanding practice of writing a lot, almost journalistic, not like journalism, but more like a journal.
Uh-huh.
Wording it helps me to savor the experience. So by noticing some experience, or, you know, we have this one flower that's grown up in our driveway bed right now, and it's the only one, and it, you know, having our attention drawn to this singular moment, I write that down. But I don't know that that necessarily becomes a poem that I would share with other people.
Uh-huh.
The language might not be all that great.
When do you know a poem's done, though? Do you have to read it out loud? Does it have to have that kind of airing?
Yeah. I was trying to help my students listen for that, and I think it's really difficult because it's intuitive. You get a sense for it, but it's also pretty deliberate. And I listen for a convergence of some kind of liveliness to the language. It can't sound like I've heard it before. And a wholeness to the experience. So if it's an image or a description, there needs to be something complete. But then there's got to be something else. Does it suggest beyond itself? And that's the part that I don't always know.
Do you let somebody else read it out loud so that you can hear what other people might hear?
I don't. I'm pretty private.
Yeah.
I don't let it out until it's pretty far along in my own process.
Huh.
I'm not sure why.
That's really interesting. How does your relationship with the poem change when you do have an audience?
I love reading aloud because it feels strangely intimate, because the poems are very, particularly these poems, have that quiet talking to myself feeling. And yet, in a public reading, there's a gathering because we're all listening so carefully. You know, listening to other people talk, maybe even on this show, is different from a poetry reading. There's an intensification to the language, but also to the experience. So I really like that. And for that to happen, the poems have to be, in my sense, the poems have to be pretty polished, pretty ready for that moment.
Yeah. So you said that this book took you a long time to put together. Is it because it went over years that you were writing it, or was the compilation of it the toughest thing?
Actually, both. I started about 10 years ago with that assembling process that I talked about earlier. And actually, a couple of the poems didn't make it in this book. They're in the previous one.
Mm.
One ended up being far more political, so it didn't fit the tone. And the other was an homage to Theodore Rethke. So it's called In a Watery Drowse with Rethke. And it was so specific to him that I address him like as if I was talking to him. And it speaks specifically about my dad and some narrative details about that. And the specificity of that didn't feel like it fit these poems.
Uh-huh.
So there were almost more poems in the book than there are.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Edward Dougherty. He is a poet and has a new collection out called Grace Street, which we are discussing and Edward is reading from. And I do want you to read another excerpt from Grace Street. This one's called Backyard Passage. Mm. To tell us about this one, too. Another beautiful one, I must say, Edward.
This, to some extent, kind of serves as the center of the book, the heart of the book, that sense of being a householder and finding grace in that. But also there's a section where I talk about the yard being kind of a place of annoyance. And it's all endless tasks. For me, it always feels like chores. And yet, that's the field of if you have a spirituality, that's where the rubber meets the road.
Exactly. That's the existence. That's what it is.
Yeah. So this is a moment where it happens pretty often, actually, recently when the space station was passing over and it was visible. We all went into the backyard and It's a strangely private place, even though it's in a pretty residential neighborhood. We have a cemetery in our backyard with these towering spruces. So it feels enclosed, in a sense, by these trees, and they feel like companions. So this poem is a walk into that backyard and what that then evoked from me. In her great age by the sea, Aunt Jane's lungs filled with salt water. Step into moon-cold night. Breathe it. Grass and heather, all silvered. It's the mansion of unknowing, mystery's home. The spirit is process, endless and inviting. From the evergreen sky, distant and near, an owl cry opens a hollow that widens beyond the yard. The passage into mystery always refreshes. So receive my pledge, drooping spruces. Take my profession, grass of my heart. I vow to vow nothing. I vow to be nothing and to the passage be true. In the company of night and all its ambassadors, the space shuttle returns to Earth. What moves through leaves a wake. In the wide V of space, we attend to currents. I am happy in our bed, your arm across my chest, sleep and the moon crossing us, slipping through.
Well, that's such a beautiful poem. It really is. Do you feel like a lot of stuff is being pulled from your unconscious?
Yeah, I like when I can start with something almost every day and prosaic, like the passing of my aunt, which isn't really every day, but everyone suffers losses. But it could be other times it was mowing the lawn or seeing all the dandelions in the backyard. They all make it into this book. And if that, particularly when I'm writing about it, in that moment, if I can open myself to how that experience means something more than itself, and that's often where the unconscious comes from.
Yeah, that's where poetry comes from.
Yeah,
really.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's where spirit lives, too.
Yeah. That's amazing when you say that your yard has a graveyard, is adjacent to a graveyard.
Yeah.
Wow. I mean, that sounds haunting just in itself.
Yeah.
That would bring out the poet in almost anyone.
It's funny how some people will respond to that with pretty strong trepidation.
Oh, I think it sounds fascinating.
But we have very quiet neighbors.
Do you read your poetry out loud to the...
No, but I have one of our neighbors is a singer, and we can hear her singing sometimes when she walks the paths in the cemetery. And it's wonderful. At first, it was a little haunting, but then we recognized the voice.
Now, you've been interested in responding to visual art, and you've written some poems and even a book, I think. Read. Well, what is that about the visual art that attracts you in regard to trying to interpret it again?
I think it begins with sometimes just word weariness. I read a lot, and I teach, and I talk, and I write. So at some points, I just get sick of my own talk, my own words. So looking at visual stuff, paintings and calligraphy and photographs, is refreshing. There's a way that it will move me that kind of cuts through language, and I love that. It seems instant, and when it works, when there's a resonance between whatever the work is and my own soul, it's beautiful. It's very moving.
Yeah. When I look at art, I'm looking for my emotional response to it.
Mm-hmm.
And I've tried a couple times to write about it, but it turns out kind of trite. You know, I don't know how to.
Well, there's
I'm
some
not
habits
sure how
that
to
we
do
can
it.
Get into where very often it can be, here I am looking at this thing, and it makes me think of this stuff.
Exactly.
Which doesn't quite rise to it.
Now, before we do run out of time, I want to have you read another excerpt from Grace Street.
Okay.
This is called The Green Spiral. Tell us a little bit about this, too.
So I think it's Hildegard of Bingen wrote, talking about the greening power of the soul, of the spirit, and that sense of springtime, new growth, calling that spiritual growth the greening power has always been a really interesting idea. It incarnates what's so abstract. So the idea of the green spiral is my way of saying it's springtime, but also that inner growth. And this section is actually it's the ending of the book, so it gathers up quite a number of things from earlier in the poems, but I think it brings together all those things in a way because it talks about time, which is utterly abstract as well as utterly mundane and everyday. So you look at what time it is, but that sense of lifetime, but also geologic time. And I try to give that an image of a fountain and a seed. trying to make it embodied. The ending of The Green Spiral. Three monks in yellow outside the conference against the death penalty chanted Nam-myoho-renge-kyo, tapping hand drums, the beat under everything that lives. I remembered your letters, wishing spring flowers fill your days ahead and may time for poetry and gardening abound for you. Tulips, some still holding their secret faces in the day's bloom, of themselves opened, heating with heart warmth the dew-cool grass and maroon stigma tips of the pear flowers. Like the moment monks sang the morning's inherent holiness, time fills and overflows, a fountain, a seed Eastering always in blossom time.
And that's a beautiful one, too.
Thank you.
Really beautiful. Well, where would you come up with the title of the book? Obviously, it's, you know, it could have to do with grace in regard to the word and in regard to religion, in regard to anything like that.
Again, it's that that mundane. I lived on a place called Grace Street in Elmira, and it also is that sense of may we live in a place that is full of grace.
Uh-huh. Did you share your work with your students?
I did this semester. I tend not to. I've had teachers who sort of saw the classroom as their way of
it was selling all about their them. Work in some ways.
Yeah. We had to buy their book, and
I always
felt a little smarmy. So, as much as I share, I try and give it as an example of here's how I do this. So let's talk about how you're going to do it. Let's try this and let's try that and let's try this. Uh-huh. So it's not here's what to do or how to do it, or even a standard to shoot for. Just, we're all makers, so here's one option that feels authentic to me.
Uh-huh. And aside from sharing your work, though, how do you inspire your students? I mean, that's probably a complicated question. But
yeah, part of me wants to say you'll have to ask my students if I actually do. So for the creative writing, my approach has been to make them do stuff. Try this. Try describing a painting or play music and write from the music and then share that and then do it again. So that out of their own experience, I can make whatever lessons about the language or poetry or rhythm or whatever. And then we try it again, and it's out of that practice that they find their own way of owning a process that results in maybe poems, maybe just interesting exercises. Mm-hmm. But out of that process, if that can generate and generate and generate, they'll almost, in a sense, begin teaching themselves.
Uh-huh. Do you believe that poetry can transform people? I mean,
I do.
There's political poetry, of course, and as well mm-hmm. as the kind of poetry that we're presenting mm-hmm. today. You think it can transform people? Can it change a culture?
Well, the only way to change a culture is to transform people. So
exactly.
I do believe that the flowering of the human spirit can be the bonds of community that we need.
Yeah. You know, we often talk about how poetry and the arts are not very valued in this culture.
Yeah.
But I have never met a soul in my life, no matter what age, who can't recite a poem that changed their life when they were a kid, moved them, got them through something. You know what I mean?
I do.
It's amazing how we undervalue this art, and yet it permeates most people's lives.
Yeah, there's a utilitarian streak to our culture that it's not valuable unless I can use it. But the use of the spirit, of prayer, of meditation, of poetry, it's harder to pin down, but you're right. I think that when you read a poem that seems to speak what you've been experiencing, and it's like you recognize yourself,
mm-hmm.
it's very powerful and very important to us. It's the way we learn how to grow.
Yeah. It's just like we experience ourselves articulated.
Yes.
You know, because
a
lot of people do not know how to
how to
communicate in many ways. Before we do run out of time, I want to talk to you about a project that I find fascinating. Poems about the World Trade Center that you have worked on and almost gotten published and perhaps will in the future. Well, tell us about it a little bit.
The manuscript is called 10048. That was the zip code of the World Trade Center. And I felt like it was almost my duty as an artist to try and grapple with this incredible social event of our time. So I began it and put it aside many, many times because the scope of it just seemed to exceed what I was able to do.
Yeah.
But like with Grace Street, I continued to return to it and read other things, and that sparked new poems. So it's been accepted for publication twice, and the contract was nullified twice. So and, it's and still none of those poems,
they haven't appeared anywhere else. This is really a body of work that you're waiting to present as a whole.
Well, there are some poems. There's one in Albany Poets publishes a magazine, and they accepted one of the poems. I think it does speak to people in ways because it humanizes an experience that's so huge.
Oh, yeah.
And it individualizes what's become so symbolic.
Yeah.
So I do think as a whole it becomes, one person said it's like one long poem, like an epic poem.
Yeah, I know there's so much art has come out of that, but we still haven't made sense of it.
Yeah.
I mean, all I can think of is that image of the falling man, of course.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the one that has taken us.
He's in the
us.
Book, too.
Yeah. Yeah.
The wire walker.
Oh, yes.
Petite. Yeah.
Yeah, it was something that's, it's like burnt into our consciousness
now. Well, now I'm teaching students who were born after 9/11, so everything that they know is received, either in stories from people they know or through the media, which is similar to my experience in Hiroshima. We were there for the 50th anniversary. So we met and listened to people who were there and survived it, but a great many of the next generations, like mine, are hearing it secondhand.
Yeah. You seem to be attracted to some of these worldwide human disasters. I was going to bring up Pilgrimage to a Ginkgo Tree, which there's lots of poems about Hiroshima and your visit, you and Beth, your wife, visited. Are you attracted to these because you're trying to make sense personally, or you're trying to obviously help the world make sense as well, right, as an artist?
Yeah, I think there's something, I would track it back to my Catholic upbringing, where if we are called to love one another, then we have to confront some of the ways in which we are really awful to one another. So it's a human dilemma, war, torture, personal violations like rape and other violences. So to gaze into that face, that awful human face, feels like a duty because those people who survived it have a lesson to teach us about the resiliency of the human spirit and the human heart. But the survivors of Hiroshima often would say, we're motivated by our terrible experience so that no one else would have to live through what we did.
Yeah.
And that sense of compassion for others is inspiring.
Yeah.
So maybe I go toward that awfulness for those beautiful virtues as well of compassion and resilience.
Yeah, and I assume that's what you want people to take from Gray Street, the current collection.
Yeah.
Because it is comforting, too.
Oh, good. I hope so. It's it took a long time to write, so if it doesn't inspire hope and comfort, I'm not sure if it's done its duty yet.
Well, we are almost out of time. Do you have contact information? Are you giving any readings in the next month or so?
I'm not, but I signed up to volunteer for Tupelo Press's 3030 project. It's a fundraiser for Tupelo Press. It's kind of like a writing marathon where poets will write 30 poems in 30 days. So look for, you can contact me through my website, Edward A. Dougherty. My last name looks like Dougherty, Dougherty. And I'll have information where you can follow the poems that are coming out in June, one at a time.
Great. Well, Edward Dougherty, thank you so much for joining us. Again,
thanks,
the book is called Gray Street, his new collection of poetry. Please go out and buy it and read it because it's beautiful. Thank you, Edward.
Thanks so much.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And we are a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Tax-deductible donations are welcome at artspire.org. That's artspire.org. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. I'm Tish Perlman. We'll be back next week.